Good morning, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Hawk Blogger Mornings. I'm Brian Emhauser. Happy to be with you on this Tuesday morning as the Seahawks are still basking in the glow of what was a very good first few days of the NFL draft and kind of reminding ourselves that this team can still do that every once in a while. I think it's been a few good drafts in a row for John Schneider and the Seahawks dating back to 2022. And we'll talk about the fruits of some of those drafts in just a moment, as there's some Seahawks news to talk about there. You know, there's a few other things I wanted to touch on. We'll get to here at the jump. Before we do that, if you haven't given the show a like and click subscribe, please do. We are closing in on 19,000 subscribers already. Love to get up to 20,000 and beyond. We will have the great Dame Brugler on with us in just about a half an hour, 10 a.m. Pacific time. One last time. Dane's going to join us for a post-draft recap, discussion, just hang out. And then he's going to turn into a pumpkin. That guy deserves a break. I'm sure his wife will be happy to have a little bit more of his attention. And so he was kind enough to agree to come on with us really before tomorrow. Tomorrow is when he's kind of going off grid. So really, really happy to have Dane. We'll go through the players. We'll have that conversation. I know you guys have all seen this, and I'm going to warn you at the outset to adjust your volume levels probably a little bit lower, because I just love this clip. And Braden, who's, you know, kind of our intern, has been helping out, put this clip together. And this is the conversation that was going on draft night ahead of the Gray Zabel selection between Evan Hill and Nathan Ernst. And I just have to share it again because it makes me laugh. So let's kick it off with that.
Over guard?
I'm not – well, is Gray Zabel even going to be there?
Looks like he might be, yeah, actually.
Well, okay, well, it looks like he might be. Okay, well, it looks like he might be. Okay, well, it looks like he might be. Okay, well, it looks like he might be.
A few moments later.
With the 18th pick in the 2025 NFL Draft, the Seattle Seahawks select Gray Zabel, guard, North Dakota State.
Yes! Yes! Let's go! Nathan! Let's go!
Oh my gosh! Thank freaking God! Oh my God!
Gray Zabel's not available at 18! What?
Oh, thank God!
Wow, come on, how can you not love those guys? And Nathan's a good sport about it. Nathan got a lot of grief from Seahawks fans who felt like he was too negative about the draft. He gave it an A. He liked the draft. He was not a big Arroyo fan, I'll give you that much, but he still gave the draft an A, and he was a big part of what has become like just a monumental weekend for this channel, for this crew. I tweeted out yesterday, I think, that we had over a million people watch our coverage across platforms, you know, over the weekend. I was wrong. It was closer to 2 million people. Like, that is wild. That is wild. That, and that's just for like 3 days. Like, I am absolutely floored by the amount of people that have tuned in, and it's fun. It's fun. I'm glad we have this crew. I'm glad we have show people that enjoy hanging out with us. I'm glad people enjoy the great guests that we bring, including amazing folks like Dame Brugler. So, yeah, thanks to everybody out there who tuned in and continues to tune into the show, because it's been a lot of fun and there's a lot of great stuff to come. I am harassing Seahawks PR as best I can to get some great guests on this week if possible. We've got rookie minicamp coming up this week. I don't exactly know what that's going to look like or what kind of access we'll get, but I will give you all the access I'm allowed to give you as that comes up. And I cannot wait. I think the person I'm most excited to watch is Jalen Milroe, for sure. I you know, the last time I saw him, the only time I saw him in person, it was not a great look. And like, it was a great interview. Nick, I think, really, really represented himself and the team well in that interview. And I recommend checking that one out. There was an interview with Gray Zabel, I think, on Chuck and Buck this morning. I haven't had a chance to listen to that one, but the guys are making their rounds. I'm going to try to see who I can get over here as well, because obviously I've got questions. And, you know, I think we'll have fun once we get some of those guys on the show as well. So the news of, like, a few bits of news. One, we'll talk about Charles Cross and his fifth-year option that was picked up. It was reported it was picked up yesterday. I'm going to talk about what a fifth-year option is. I'm going to talk about what price it is, what the significance of it is. I'll talk about the conversation that goes around it, people talking about that Seahawks haven't exercised fifth-year options before. And so I'm going to walk you through that. You might be like, oh, my God, I don't care. You might be like, thanks, I didn't know all this, and I've been curious. We'll find out, but I'll share that. I want to talk a little bit about the Jalen Milroe situation and this notion of how he could be used as a Wildcat quarterback and the emergency quarterback rule. So I want to clarify a couple things there. And before I get to those two things, and then we will welcome in Dame Brugler after that. I was having fun with 49ers fans this morning, and it wouldn't shock me if they all start showing up in the chat. We'll see. But, you know, George Kittle signs an extension. And I mean, okay, George Kittle is in his 30s, has been dealing with injuries, and they signed him to a 4-year extension. My reaction to that was, you know, I quote tweeted it and said there, 49ers keep their aging core together for a few more years. And 49ers fans are so butthurt about that. Like, it is really funny how much cope is out there. And they're like, well, you wish you had George Kittle. And if George Kittle had played against the Seahawks, you guys would have never won. I'm like, wait, so you're making the case that my tweet about your aging core is somehow off base because your aging tight end was injured for a game and would have, you know, beaten the Seahawks if he played. I hate to break it to you, 49ers fans, but part of having an aging core is they tend to miss games. And if you look at your draft, which, by the way, we'll talk about with Dame Brugler, I want to walk him around the AFC, NFC West. They did not draft an offensive lineman until very late. And it looks like our good pal Pete Carroll snaked them with not one, but two offensive tackle picks immediately before the 49ers were due to pick. And it's not just George Kittle that's aging. It is Trent Williams. And Trent Williams, I believe, is the foundation of that entire team. When he's out, they lose. And he's 37 years old and has been injured increasingly, missed more and more time. Every year I'm like, not sure. Like, is he going to make, is this his last year? He's on that watch. And they do not have, even the guy that they had backing him up was signed by the Chiefs. So I actually like the 49ers draft. If you heard my draft coverage, I think the combination of CJ West and Alfred Collins was a really smart double dip on the interior of the defensive line. And it kind of pokes at a weakness of the Seahawks draft, which is they didn't get the run stuffing interior defenders that I was hoping that they would get out of this class. Both Alfred Collins and CJ West were guys that I thought would have been interesting fits for the Seahawks, especially CJ West a little bit later than, you know, when Alfred Collins was picked. So I actually think the 49ers did okay for themselves in this draft. There's some people that are much more critical about their draft class than I am, but they did not address the offensive line. And my goodness, I think that's a very bold move. And so I kind of look at that team, and that fan base is, when Grant Cohen came on with me last week before the draft and he said that they were delusional, I hadn't really interacted with them for a while. I'd mostly just seen them freaking out about how they'd lost all these players. They've now talked themselves into the only guy that they lost that was really worth anything was Dre Greenlaw, and that Nick Martin is now the linebacker they drafted is going to be as good as Dre Greenlaw, and their defensive line is all going to be great, and they're going to win it all. Like that's kind of where 49ers fans' head seems to be, which is crazy. The other thing that I enjoy about the 49ers fan reaction to some of the tweets today was so they used to just love to hate on Geno Smith, like how terrible he was, how he could never beat the 49ers. And then he goes in and he beats them in San Francisco last year. And I was in the press box. Man, that was the hardest time for me to not root and cheer in the press box. I'll tell you that much. And I got to go down and stand on that field and do a post game show from their field with a Seahawks win, with Geno Smith being the one who walked him off. Now they're saying, hey, you signed Brock Purdy's backup for $33 million to be your starter. Good luck with that. Guys, I'm telling you, it's going to be so tasty when Sam Darnold and Mike McDonald, Jalen Milroe, Cooper Kupp, JSN, you know, the whole crew goes down there, or they come up here and the Seahawks beat them. Like, that is still my favorite team to beat. It's not even close. The Rams fans are getting pretty obnoxious, but you know, the 49ers fans, my goodness. So that was a little bit of note on the 49ers, but let me talk quickly about the emergency quarterback rule, so you guys can have an idea. If you're dreaming along with me that Jalen Milroe is going to be, you know, an emergency quarterback, well, he's not going to be an emergency, that he is going to be a wildcat quarterback for the Seahawks next year, and then he's going to get 8 to 10 snaps, and there'll be a package for him that they could use on third down and short, or fourth down and short, or that they could use them in the goal line, red zone, all that kind of stuff. Well, the way that the emergency quarterback rule works, just so people understand, is that there's a few ways that Jalen Milroe could be active and available to be used. One, and this is obvious, he's active on game day. So you make the 53-man roster, and then there's a subset of players that are available to be active on game day. You remember every game day, they tell you, here's the inactives. Inactives are players that are on the 53-man roster, but are not going to play in the game that day. So one way for Jalen Milroe to play in games is to be active. Great. That's an easy one. Another way, but for him to be active, or for him to get playing time, another way for him to play is to be an emergency quarterback. And that would mean that he is on the 53-man roster, all right, but he is not on the active list for the game. So he's on the inactive list. But the only way you can, that's essentially what's called the emergency quarterback. That's your third quarterback. He's on the 53, but he's not on the active list for the game day. But there is a rule about the emergency quarterback. You cannot use them in wildcat formations or specialty packages. And you can only use the emergency quarterback if both of your other active quarterbacks are injured and unavailable. So if you want Jalen Milroe to play and be available for that wildcat kind of specialty package, he cannot be your emergency quarterback. He's either got to be active. Well, he has to be active if you want that to be the case. And for him to be active, that either means the Seahawks have to have three quarterbacks active with Sam Darnold, Drew Lock, and Jalen Milroe. Or there's another possibility here that I think is worth thinking about, which is they may have Jalen Milroe as the active quarterback and Drew Lock as the emergency quarterback. And the way that would work is Jalen Milroe would be getting playing time, And if in game Sam Darnold was hurt, Jalen Milroe would have to be the backup. And if it was an injury that lasted more than just that game, I think what you'd see happen most likely is Drew Lock would be the starter. So it would be this kind of weird thing where Drew Lock might technically be the number two, the backup, but he might not be active on game days. So this is just me thinking way too far ahead, but I wanted to at least share that nuance, because if, like me, you've been imagining Jalen Milroe being this weapon, he's got to be on the active roster on game days. And if they're going to have all three quarterbacks active, that's not very typical. That's going to mean you're going to be thin somewhere else at some other position group on the roster. That could affect special teams, that it could affect all sorts of position groups. And also keep in mind, with you having a fullback most likely now, that's another spot that you generally didn't have to account for. That's going to affect how many running backs or how many other like players that you're going to have active. So this is way, way, way early to be talking about this, but it is going to be a little bit of a different mix or some different decisions for the Seahawks to make in terms of who's active on game days. All right. So that is the emergency quarterback rule. Just wanted to clarify that for people that didn't know about how that would work. Let's talk about Charles Cross. Let's talk about Charles Cross, and let's talk about fifth year option. So it was reported yesterday that Charles Cross is going to have his fifth year option picked up by the Seahawks. That means that his 2026 contract is now set at $17.56 million. Okay. And there's a few things that I think are worth understanding about fifth year options, how this works, what this means. Let's just start with a simple thing. If the Seahawks hadn't picked up Charles Cross's fifth year option, he would be an unrestricted free agent next year after this season. So now he is no longer an unrestricted free agent next season. He is under contract with the team for 2026. And the price of that deal next year is $17.56 million. That's a nice big bump for Charles Cross because, you know, he is making, let's see, what was his APY? I don't have the perfect number here. So 5.3 APY. So he'll go from 5.3 to 17.5. That's a nice big jump. And does that mean that the Seahawks aren't going to try to extend him? No. But what it means is they're not in a rush to. They don't have to rush to do so because they know that they've got him for that price. They are happy to pay him $17.5 million next year. That is a fine number for them to pay him. They got plenty of cap space. And if you're curious, $17.5 million as an APY is 3, 6, 9, 12, 14th. Would make him the 14th highest paid left tackle in the NFL. You know, that is not a price you're like going to worry about paying. So that's one piece. The other piece is this allows the Seahawks that if they choose to, they don't have to negotiate an extension this year. They don't have to pay the signing bonus this year, the cash this year. They can do that next offseason if they want. And if they were to do that, then they can, you know, renegotiate. They can like negotiate that fifth year. If they want, they can change that number. They can move all sorts of things around. My guess is he will never actually play under that fifth year option. They'll sign him to an extension. The only question is when they will do it, whether it'll be this year, whether it'll be next year. Doesn't really matter. It only matters from a Seahawks perspective in terms of, you know, where the cash is going to hit in their budget and on the cap. And then also, you know, whether you think that you want to risk signing him before or you want to see more from him, all that's fine. So that's kind of where things fall with the kind of the fifth year option basics. The other pieces that I think are worth, you know, maybe understanding. And again, we're going to have Dane Brugler join us here in about 10 minutes. Looking forward to Dane joining us. But the way fifth year options work is there's actually different levels of fifth year options. So what this is, it's only for first round picks. All right. If you didn't know that, it's only for first round picks. And there's four levels. The first level is what's called basic. The basic level is just players who basically don't meet any of the higher levels. So that's just the basic level. And the way that the basic level option salary is arrived at is an average of the third to 25th highest salaries at that specific position over the past 5 years. So between the third and 25th, keep in mind the 25th. So it's basically the, you know, it's the lowest price you're going to get on a fifth year option for a rookie. And the other important thing there is that it's by position. So the fifth year option for a linebacker or an edge player or a cornerback or a quarterback or a left tackle is going to be different. So like, for example, the basic fifth year option for Drake London, who's a wide receiver, would and was drafted right before Charles Cross, would be $15.5 million. The basic fifth year option for Charles Cross would be $16.7 million. So it's a full, you know, million plus more than the wide receiver, because left tackles are paid more than wide receivers, right? So that's the basic. The next level up is playtime related. And this means that they've played 75% or greater of the snaps in two of their first three seasons. And an average of they have to meet one of these criteria, either 75% or greater snaps in two of the first three seasons, an average of 75% or greater over all three seasons, or 50% or greater over all three seasons. Charles Cross meets all of these things. So Charles Cross is the second level. It's called the playtime level of fifth year options. There are two additional options that are much more clear cut. The option beyond playtime is that you make one Pro Bowl. If you've made one Pro Bowl and it has to be on the original ballot, it can't be an alternate or anything like that, then you get the one Pro Bowl level. Multiple Pro Bowls is the fourth and final level. So if you made more than one Pro Bowl within your first 4 years, you will get that level. So I believe Devin Witherspoon will qualify for this multiple Pro Bowl level when he is due for his fifth year option. What would it be? It would be next year. Okay. So next year, the Seahawks will have to decide on both Devin Witherspoon and Jaxon Smith-Njigba. Jaxon Smith-Njigba, did he make a Pro Bowl? Yeah. I think he was added to the roster to replace an injured Terry McLaurin. So I don't think that qualifies, but I do think Devin Witherspoon has made it on the initial ballot both times. So I think he will qualify for the fifth year. And then if JSN, I don't think JSN can qualify for the multiple Pro Bowl, but he could, if he makes the Pro Bowl on the original ballot, still qualify for that next year. So Charles Cross is at the playtime level. That's 17.56. If he had made one Pro Bowl, that would have jumped up to 21.2. If he had made two Pro Bowls, that would have jumped up to 23.4. So the Seahawks are getting a very good deal with Charles Cross. I think that you should expect, once he signs an extension, that he is going to be definitely among the top 10 paid left tackles in football. Maybe among the top five, not because he is one of the best five, but just from a, you know, youth and when your contract comes up and what the market is. I think he's going to get probably around, I would guess around 23 to 24 million a year would be my best guess of what his eventual extension will be. If that was the case, he would be among the top five in salary for left tackles. So that's kind of where we are. This is something that John Schneider's been very cagey about up until even this past week when Bob Condotta asked him about it. And he said, well, I've got a few more days, don't I? I don't know if that it was indicating that they were trying to agree to an extension. And if they didn't, they were just going to, you know, take this fifth year option. It seemed like to me they were going to do it the whole time. If you look at the players from that draft class and you walk through which of them have had their fifth year's options picked up. Trayvon Walker was the first pick in the draft. The Jags picked up his fifth year. Aiden Hutchinson, second pick. His fifth year option was picked up. Derek Stingley Jr., the cornerback. They picked up his fifth year option. Then they signed him to an extension. Sauce Gardner was a fourth pick. His fifth year option was picked up. Kayvon Thibodeau for the Giants. His fifth year option was picked up. Ikem Ekwonu, the tackle that was picked by the Panthers. They picked up his fifth year option, which is kind of interesting to me. He has not played that well. He did play better last year. Evan Neal, who went to the Giants, and I will admit openly that I was hoping the Seahawks would get Evan Neal. He went to the Giants at number 7, and they are not picking up his fifth year option. Drake London, as I mentioned, the wide receiver for the Falcons, they have not decided yet, or at least I haven't seen it yet. I would assume they're going to pick up his fifth year option, but we'll find out. And then Charles Cross is number 9, and obviously they did that. After Charles Cross, Garrett Wilson had his fifth year option picked up by the Jets. Chris Olave, his fifth year option was picked up by the Saints. Jameson Williams, number 12 overall, the Lions had his fifth year option picked up. And then other than Tyler Smith at number 24 to the Cowboys had his fifth year option picked up. I assume the Ravens will pick up Tyler Linderbaum's fifth year option. The Chiefs will probably pick up Trent McDuffie's, I would assume. So those are probably the guys that are going to have their fifth year options picked up this year. And this conversation that continues about, well, John Schneider hasn't picked up fifth year options. Well, his first fifth year option, he could technically, but when the rule came into play, would have been Bruce Irvin. I think actually James Carpenter. Was it James Carpenter? I can't remember. It's either James Carpenter or Bruce Irvin. And from there, it was like Bruce Irvin, Jermaine Ifedi, Rashad Penny, LJ Collier, Jordan Hicks were the guys before. And I mean, they weren't going to pick up LJ Collier regardless. Rashad Penny, you know, had the injury issues. Ifedi, no, didn't make sense. And then, you know, Bruce Irvin, I think obviously they extended him maybe multiple times, but he was someone who was going to get the linebacker fifth year option level. And that's like the edge rusher level. Makes it a pretty expensive price. And so that's why they didn't pick it up back then. I think going forward, we should expect Devin Witherspoon, JSN, I would expect both their fifth year options to be picked up. 2 years, when it's Byron Murphy's turn, I'm expecting that he will have earned a fifth year option. I think Gray Zabel will. So I think this is going to be something that is more commonplace in the future, but is new to the Seahawks now. So without further ado, let's bring in the man, the myth, the exhausted, Dane Brugler to our show. Dane, man, it is so good to see you. And I just want to congratulate you on a absolutely kick-ass 2025 draft season, all the coverage you did. How you doing, man?
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. You too. I mean, it was a fun last few months. This is such a weird draft, right? And so the way it played out, the way all the noise with these quarterbacks, mm-hmm. you know, it was just interesting that the way things actually played out. We only had two go in the first round. only had some of the guys that fell maybe further than we thought. But it was a great 3 days. We spent so long projecting, and now it's fun talking about fit and where these guys ended up and how it's going to look. And so that's a fun pivot after months and months of just kind of a lot of guesswork.
So what happens for Dane Brugler in the next few weeks? What do you do now?
We got a Little League baseball game tonight. My focus shifts towards coaching my daughter in softball, my son in baseball. They're 9 and 10 or 8 and 10. So, it's a fun age for that. And so I very much look forward to that as kind of the getaway and chance to step away from scouting for a little bit. So the month of May, I take it very casual. And then really around Memorial Day is when I dive right back in and head, really plan towards next year in the 2026 class. But no, I'll definitely these next few weeks, take it easy, kind of review this draft. I also look back and do a lot of self-scouting from previous years. Now that I can catch my breath and look back to, the draft from 2-3 years ago and say, all right, what did we miss on? What did we get right? Now that we have a sample size of these guys in the NFL and how they're playing. So, yeah, the month of March or month of May is definitely a little bit of a step back, both for me. I can spend time with the family, hang out a little bit, mow the lawn, do all that fun stuff, but also kind of make sure, my process is on point and not just this draft class, because if I graded a player as a third round pick and you went in the fifth round pick, it doesn't really tell me anything. I care more about being right 2-3 years from now when these guys actually get on the field in the NFL, more so than being right on draft weekend, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So the month of May is definitely a big part of that process.
So we're going to not talk about what everyone else is going to talking about with the draft, Shedeur Sanders. That's not going to be a conversation for this show. We'll let everyone else handle that.
Yeah.
I do want to talk about a guy that plays that same position that got drafted in the third round by the Seahawks, and a guy that I have been pretty openly, I was at the Senior Bowl, same as you. I saw what I saw there, and I was like, I think this guy's a major project as a passer, but has the potential to be a real weapon. What do you make of the Seahawks taking him at 92? How do you think that fits in Seattle? What's your take on Jalen Milroe and his potential to be, what's his floor and what's his ceiling from your perspective?
Yeah, I mean, after I reported that he was going to be at the draft, there was a lot of, he's going first round or he's going top 50. You wouldn't be there unless he had assurances that he's going top 50. And I kind of pushed back on that a little bit, because I didn't push back on it a lot because I wouldn't have been shocked if he went top 50. All it takes is one team to fall in love with the player. So, but I pushed back a little bit because, like you said, this is a project. And as exciting as the upside of potential is with Jalen Milroe, it's still, I remember talking to a scout as we were leaving Mobile and kind of catching up the day after we left. And I said, what'd you think of, Milroe was tough, right? What'd you think? And he said, I forgot he was there. I totally forgot. He didn't stand out in any one way, at least in a positive way. It was not something, and you could tell he was mentally swimming throughout the week of practice there because he was clearly working on his footwork, his technique, just trying to get everything in unison and in sync. And he was thinking way too much. And that led to even more inconsistencies than I think it showed on tape throughout the season for Alabama. But just keep coming back to how electric of an athlete he is. I'll never forget. There was a scout at the Alabama Georgia game. He was on the sidelines and he told me he has never seen a player in person, any position, be that fast on a football field. He's never seen it before. And this guy, he's been scouting double digit years, probably 10 years now. So that says a lot. And, that type of dynamic ability with his legs certainly showed in the box score, showed on tape, the amount of explosive plays he created with his legs. And he also created a lot of explosive plays with his arm. I mean, the fact that he had 16 passing touchdowns this year and they averaged 36.6 yards per touchdown is ridiculous. But it's the consistency factor is not there. And you watch Oklahoma tape, you watch a Michigan tape, and you see a guy who is just doesn't have a great pocket feel right now. His accuracy is very up and down. You know, it's just he's still learning how to play the quarterback position. But where the Seahawks got him, that's where, okay, you know, if you have to draft him at 40 to get him on your team, that just seemed very rich to me. If I can get him at 90, okay, that changes everything. That's where it feels like this is worth the gamble. This is worth that dice roll. And if it works out, great. If it doesn't, hey, we might have a awesome running back on our roster that we can use. But you know that the legs are there, the athleticism, you know, the arm is there. And he's a really smart guy. He won the academic Heisman. You know, he comes from a very strict household. Like, it's not like, you know, you worry about him and how he's going to adapt to an NFL playbook. And like, he has what it takes. It's just a matter of getting everything on the same page. And, you know, the coaches at Alabama speak very highly of him, his mental toughness, the way that, you know, he wants it. So, yeah, if I'm the Seahawks and I get him where I got him, I'm feeling pretty good about that.
Yeah, Dane, that's exactly my reaction. And people talk about it as a big swing. And I don't know that a third round pick can really be a big swing. And I don't. Right. And I also imply that there's. Pick. Right. I don't know that it even implies that it does imply that there's some kind of low floor for him. For me, like the worst case scenario, quote, worst case scenario for Jalen Milroe is that he has a wildcat, like sub package kind of role. And that's it. Like that's not like when your strengths are one of the best runners of the football, maybe in the game, but at least at the quarterback position. You have elite character and work ethic, and you have a big arm. I don't think the floor's that low. Like if he was someone who was a great athlete who didn't like to work and wasn't smart and wasn't a great teammate, right, then it's a different situation. So I agree with you on all those points. Talk to us about the Seahawks class in general. How do you feel about it? What was your reaction to their entire class?
I was a big fan. I don't do draft grades, but what I do is I just kind of power rank my favorite draft classes 1 through 32. And I mean, there weren't really any draft classes I hated or despised, but you know, somebody has to be 25. Somebody has to be 30, 31, 32. Mm-hmm. The Seahawks finished third. So clearly I was a big fan of what they did. Starts with Gray Zabel at the top, you know, wait, felt like chalk, you know, obviously is something that we made this connection, really, I think at the combine, you know, I wouldn't say Zabel came out of nowhere, because you go back to Halloween, my top 50 at Halloween, he was in there. So I already viewed him as kind of like a top 50 pick mid season. And then he goes to the Senior Bowl and it's like, okay, nope, this is a first round pick, because he was just dominant center guard, played more reps than anybody. Goes to the combine, doesn't do everything, but what he does do, he looks really good. And then he just checked every box throughout the process. And so he went from in the summer, he was kind of like probably a third round pick around there. Mid season, the way he played, it's like, all right, no, this guy's going to go somewhere in the second round. And he was in my top 50 at Halloween. Then we get to the Senior Bowl and it's like, nope, this guy's going to go first round. He's just too good. And then we get to the combine in the pre-draft workouts and we're talking about him top 20. And there was buzz up until the draft about him going top 15. You know, the Cowboys liked him. The Dolphins liked him. I had him to Miami in my final mock draft, and it ends up he's still on the board for the Seahawks at 18 and just a perfect fit for what they want to do, what they want to be, the needs that they have. So for player, for team, love the fit there. And then to come back in the second round and get Nick Emenwori, who, you know, it feels like he's in good hands with mm-hmm. Coach McDonald. You know, you think about what he did in Baltimore with Kyle Hamilton. You know, it's whether or not he's, you know, he's different than Cam Chancellor, but just the idea, the vibes he gives is something similar to that, which is fun. But to get Emenwori in the second round like that was, like I said, tremendous value. And I think, you know, the combine numbers are what's going to drive the conversation with Nick. But talking to his teammates at the combine, because I asked three or four of his teammates about him, and they specifically pointed out how hard he works and how smart he is as the reasons why he was tough to cover during practice. Not necessarily he was faster and bigger and stronger. It was more about just how he sees the game and how, you know, the read react, the mental quickness. And so you put all that all together and, you know, I think it'd be pretty exciting. And then they also had one of my favorite day three picks this year with Torrey Horton, who, if not for that knee injury, we'd be talking about him being off the board somewhere in the top 75, top 60 picks. Had the knee injury, so had a little bit of that discount sticker on his tag. But yeah, he's going to come in from day one and compete for a starting job. You know, I like him best as a Z, like him on the outside where he can, you know, use that when he can stretch out his stride and use that speed, he can be a vertical threat. He'd be a catch and go threat, crossers. He can just affect the defense in a lot of ways and put them in conflict. So to get him in the, on day three, love that fit.
Yeah, it's you're hitting on all the top ones there, and it's funny with Nicky Minwori because there were some kind of hit jobs out there, and like Bob McInn's article, there was an anonymous scout talking about, you know, things about him, and every interaction I've had with the guy or that I've listened to, I don't know where that's coming from. So it rubs me a little bit the wrong way, these anonymous like hit jobs that come out there about these young men and that are not then supported by teammates or coaches. Like, I'm sure you run into all that kind of stuff throughout, but yeah. Setting all that aside, you mentioned Torrey Horton. The Seahawks, depending on what stats you look at, they end up with the third best yards per route run receiver in this draft class against man coverage in Torrey Horton. They end up with the best receiver in yards per route run against zone coverage in Ricky White. Now Ricky White also blocked four punts in special teams, you know, and he had this thing where he ran like a 4.6 at the combine and then he runs a 4.4 or something at his pro day. What happened where Ricky White is in the seventh round, and what happened with Damian Martinez being in the seventh round?
With White, I think he's such a lean guy, skinny guy. And I think, yeah, the questions were how consistent would he be as an NFL receiver? Now, the fact that he was so productive on special teams, that's kind of like, all right, that at the very least, we're getting a guy that can be a fifth receiver on the roster and then also help you out on special teams. Because that's he clearly showed that that's what he could do. And he's, it's not that just speed with him. Like you talk to his coaches and they will tell you how prideful he is with special teams. Like he cares a lot about that. It's a very important part of his game. So not only, and it's not just, you know, blocking punts, but he'll play on kickoff return coverages. He was a two-time team captain. So there's a lot of things about him that like, just if you just watch the receiver tape and nothing else, you say, okay, like good, but there's some holes in his game. But then you factor in the special teams, you factor in, you know, like I said, two-time team captain, the fact that he's just a quality teammate and what he's going to bring to the roster. Again, no brainer to get him at that point in the draft. Damian Martinez, I wasn't a big Damian Martinez guy. Like I never understood the top 100 love for him. Like he's big, he's physical, and he will look to run over guys. But just, I don't know. I saw a lack of speed and it's like a lack of make you miss. And, you know, I understand he's a very certain type of running back. And if that's what you want, then, you know, he's going to make sense for you. But in today's NFL, I think it's going to be a lot tougher to be productive when you're just trying to run over guys. You know, he had some off-field stuff. He had the DUI, you know, he doesn't play special teams. So that's like, you know, if you want your second or third running back, like you need to be able to play special teams in order to justify why you have a roster spot. So I think that hurt him with a lot of teams. But you know what? If you were looking for a bruiser, a guy that is no nonsense and is going to try and run over you, he's got the physicality, Damian Martinez, I mean, that's what he is. He's a power back and he's not afraid to do the dirty work. So not surprised he fell a little bit, especially in a deep running back class like this, where there's a lot of different options because he's a certain type of back. But if that's the type of back you're looking for, he certainly fits the bill.
One of the players we haven't talked about is Elijah Arroyo. tight end they picked at 50. And, you know, at Senior Bowl, I came in and Arroyo, Harold Fannin were guys that were like, these are crazy athletes. You got to see them. And I was watching Arroyo warm up and I was like, okay. And then I saw Terrence Ferguson. I was like, actually, I was kind of surprised. Terrence Ferguson moves pretty well. Like, I actually liked the way he moved a little bit better even. And Mason Taylor, I watched him make these out of frame catches on off target throws from Jalen Milroe, as a matter of fact. But like, I walked out of there like, wow, Mason Taylor, Terrence Ferguson, I was way more impressed with. And I didn't necessarily come away super impressed with Arroyo. I wasn't down on him, but those other two guys caught my attention a little bit more. They both ended up going ahead of Elijah Arroyo. Was that a surprise to you at all?
No, I mean, Mason Taylor, he finished as a borderline first round pick for me. Yeah, he was like 33, I think, on my final top 100. So not a surprise there. And Terrence Ferguson was one of my favorite players in the draft. I mean, even I probably even still had him too low. But if you had to ask who my favorite players in the draft were, he would have been in the top three or four. Ferguson, wish he was a little bit better blocker, but as a receiver, as an athlete, he's awesome. Arroyo, I had a little bit of a different reaction at the Senior Bowl, because I left the Senior Bowl thinking, okay, Arroyo's better than I thought. Like, because I think people had trouble covering him consistently, and he caught the ball well. Speed really stood out, and that's what the tape says. You know, he led all tight ends in the FBS, and you know, almost 17 yards per catch. You know, especially down the seam, and the way he can attack the defense, and before you know, safeties have a chance to react, he's by you. And so, you know, him and Cam Ward had a really nice connection this past year. I know, you know, he had a knee in the past, and that was something that some teams brought up, because that really plagued him really his 2022 and 2023 seasons. That's why he had, you know, like 10 catches in his entire first 3 years in the program. But this past year, as a fourth year guy, that's where he was really able to blossom and kind of show what he can do down the field. Needs to be more consistent, no doubt. But he gives the Seahawks a different, you know, maybe a long-term answer at the position, and a guy that has yet to play his best football. So I don't know how much of a factor he will be immediately, but it's, you know, as the tight end depth chart changes over the next 2 years, I think Arroyo has a real chance to cement himself as maybe a playmaker on this team.
And Dane, you should be taking a victory lap for all sorts of reasons, but one of them was earlier on this show, you gave me a name, happened to be a name I like as well, Bryce Cabledew, as a guy to watch out for the Seahawks. And sure enough, I was talking about him from like the fourth round on, and sixth round comes and they call the name. Tell us a little bit about why you thought Bryce Cabledew was a good fit.
Yeah, I think he fits exactly what they want. He's a, you know, good sized player, good athlete, really explosive, you know, a college tackle, but probably going to kick inside to guard. He was my highest ranked non-combine guy this year. So, you know, didn't get an invite. But when you watch him on film, because the other Kansas tackle, Logan Brown, he did have a combine invite. You know, he was considered to be this big time player, but it was Cabledew. And then when you watch a Kansas State, it was Cabledew who continued to stand out. So I really, you know, rangy. So when you think about what Seahawks want to be on offense, he fits perfectly with the movement skills, his ability to get out of his stance, use his hips, show off that range. And so he's a really smart player too. You know, you especially see it when teams try to, or defensive lines try to run games and delays and blitzes. He picks it up really quickly. I mean, he's a smart, smart guy. So consistency is needed, no doubt, just in terms of his leverage. He tends to set tall, just making sure his feet and hands are on the same page. So just overall consistency as a pass protector in the run game is definitely kind of the next step for him. But man, watching him live during East-West Shrine practices and then going back and watching the tape, then it was kind of like, all right, this guy's a draftable player for sure. And for teams that run, you know, especially outside zone, and teams that want the athletic movers, he's going to be a fit. And so, yeah, I'm glad I brought him up way back when to you, because that's I just think of that Seattle offense and what they want to be. Cable News kind of like the day three version of Zabel, you know, like it's there's reason, you know, he's not nearly as consistent, not nearly as buttoned up with his technique and certain areas of his game, but he's explosive. He's tough. And you feel like, you know, with that competitive edge that he has, we have not seen him play his best football yet. So eager to see him get coached up and see what he can do.
Dane, this is the list of undrafted free agents and minicamp invites for the Seahawks. I'm curious if there's any names on this list that jump out to you. I mean, there's the Jared Ivey. There's a couple names, Jackson Woodard, Zy Alexander, the corner. I'm curious if any Thor Griffith, defensive tackle, any of these guys kind of catch your eye for the Seahawks.
Woodard's definitely interesting because I really liked his tape. And he was a guy that was super productive, tackles, interceptions, super productive player. But didn't work out at the combine. And then at his pro day, he punched his ticket to be undrafted, unfortunately. 6'2", 230, and ran close to a 4.9. You know, the three cone was bad, the short shuttle was bad. Just did not work out well. And that he went from as one scout put it to me, he went from a fifth round pick to a PFA just based on the pro day. And it was a bummer because he has really good tape and the production is outstanding. So he would definitely be a guy that you target as a PFA, as someone who maybe we don't want to use a draft pick on him. You know, the athleticism really worries us. But man, he makes plays on film and he did it consistently. So that is really, I mean, you could probably say the same thing about Jared Ivey, because you watch that Ole Miss defensive line this year and they had so many dudes, Ivey being one of them. But again, the pro day, because he didn't work out the combine, at his pro day at 275 pounds, ran a 5.15 in the 40. The vert was bad. Three cone was bad. Like, just the pro day, the workout information, the testing just wasn't draftable. And so I'm surprised he went undrafted. I thought he would probably get in there. You know, I thought based on tape, you're thinking, hey, he might go fourth round, fifth round. Then the testing comes. It's all right. Sixth round, seventh round. So a little surprised that he just didn't get drafted. But for, you know, again, you feel like in free agency as a PFA, you're getting a guy that in high school is a big time football and basketball player, goes to Ole Miss, and he just shines. And he played a lot of different ways. He could stand up on the edge, he'd play him inside. And he was just a really active player. And so you feel like you add him to your defensive line rotation, and it wouldn't be surprised at all if he's able to earn a roster spot during training camp.
All right. So last thing I wanted to talk to you about, Dane, is the rest of the NFC West, because, you know, it's a relative sport. You got to just be better than the guy across from you. How do you feel like the other three teams in the NFC West did relative to the Seahawks?
I liked what the Cardinals did a lot. I think that, you know, they had a lot of picks. They had very few picks, and then they kind of moved around a little bit. And at the end of the day, you feel like they got better. And we talked about value with the Seahawks. You think about the Cardinals in the second round and to get Will Johnson, the corner from Michigan. Now, obviously, there were speed concerns, but more importantly, durability concerns. The knee, some soft tissue injuries. That was kind of the concern with him. I still didn't think he'd fall as far as he did. That was a big surprise. But again, once you get to that point in the draft, I mean, geez, 47, I believe. I mean, that's you roll the dice at that point. And I think he's a perfect fit for Gannon's defense. And they needed another corner. Sean Murphy Bunting he was more of a liability than a strength for them last year. So, you know, you hope Will Johnson's able to come in and compete for a job pretty quickly. Sticking with Big Ten players, they got Cody Simon as well. And I think he was in the fourth round. You know, their linebacker, and Mac Wilson's not a bad player, and I know they signed Davis Gaither, but Simon, you feel like can come in, compete for a potential starting job and be someone that factors in right away. But yeah, Walter Nolan being the first round pick, that'll be the one that this draft hinges on for the Cardinals. A player who if he plays to his full potential, you know, I think he has a chance to be, you know, one of the steals of this draft. Talking about Walter Nolan, it's just, can you get him to play at his best at a consistent level? Rams not having that first round pick. That was something, you know, it's a long play for them. We'll see how that turns out next year, you know, having two first rounders, but to get Terrence Ferguson on day two, you know, you hate to see that if you're a Seahawks fan, just because it's a perfect fit for them. And, you know, I think we'll see him compete, pretty early, for them and be a factor. And then the Niners, you know, they wanted to come into this draft to get better on the defensive line. And, you know, that was the plan. And they thought they executed that plan. So I think it might be not immediate, you know, a guy like Mikal Williams, it's 20 years old. It's going to take a little bit of time for him, but you know, I think in the long term, I think they'll be pretty happy with what they did on the defensive line.
Yeah. I hate to say it, but I liked what the 49ers did double dipping there on the interior with Alfred Collins and CJ West, two guys, you know, we had talked about as potential fits for the Seahawks. And if there's a criticism of the Seahawks draft, it's that this is a pretty darn good nose tackle class that doesn't come around that often. And they exited without one. And, and the one defensive lineman they got was Riley Mills, and he's injured. Like, high effort player. I'd love to hear your thoughts on Riley Mills and usage of that pick in the fifth round, relative to other places they could have gone.
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely not that nose. That's not his game. He's more exactly. of a three. He's more of, you know, you want to put him over the B gap and use his size and quickness to, you know, he was a freaks guy for Bruce Feldman. So, I mean, he has the movement skills, the athleticism, and he led the team in sacks. So when he exited, I think it was the Indiana game in the playoff for Notre Dame, that was a huge, huge a bummer for them. And, you know, they still made the national title game, but not having that presence up front, you know, that was a huge factor in them falling just short. But, you know, you love the energy that he plays with. You love the quickness that he plays with. As long as the injury, you know, the knee injury is nothing that the team feels like will hinder
him. He's recovering well.
As long as that's the case, yeah. I mean, in the fifth round, I think that I totally get it at that point. So, you know, because he can win in the run game. You know, as a pass rusher, like I said, he led the team in sacks. So there's a lot to like about him at that point in the draft.
Do you think where do you think he would have been drafted if he hadn't been injured? And two, he had talked about one of the guys whose game he really respects is Zach Allen. Do you think that that's a ceiling for him, like a reasonable comp of who he could become?
That's not bad. I think that makes sense. Kind of a little bit of a little bit of a hybrid where you can play outside, can play inside. He's going to fit different schemes. So I like that. You know, size wise, the way they move, a little tight, they play a little high, but they're really strong with their hands, and they're purposeful with their hands. So they can, it's not just, I'm going to out quick you. It's, I'm going to use different techniques with push pull and, you know, get underneath you and use your weight against you. And, you know, he understands how to play the hand game and hand to hand combat and all that. So if he were fully healthy, I think he would have went top 100 there. He had a lot of love among scouts.
All right, Dane, last thing, and then I'll let you get on with your downtime. You look back on this whole process for the 2025 draft. Give me your favorite story. It can be about a player. It can be about, you know, an interaction with a coach. What are you going to look back and remember as a story on the 2025 draft?
That's a good question. I mean, I always go back to Siobhan Revelle, and I think we talked about him before, about just, you know, his journey to the NFL and how just inspiring that was. You know, I think that a couple of these Cowboys players, like Tyler Booker, seeing him go 12, like we had talked once, maybe he'll fall out of the first round because athletic testing was so bad. Mm-hmm. But that's the team's just believing, like, hey, he's a good football player. And that's exactly what he is. He has the film. He has the mentality, and teams trusting that. So, you know, like, this is I think my number one takeaway from this this draft is going to be teams trusting what they saw in film and everything with the interviews with these quarterbacks. Like, who would have guessed that Dylan Gabriel would have gone ahead of Shedeur Sanders? But yeah. Look, it just reinforces how important the spring is for quarterbacks. Mm-hmm. You know, the All-Star games, the interviews, it's so important. Yeah, the tape matters. Of course it does. What you do during the season matters in a big way, but so does the spring, especially for the quarterbacks. And so seeing Dylan Gabriel go in the top three rounds was awesome for him, because he's just a guy that when he transferred to Oregon, he showed up in his minivan and immediately took control of that team. Like, it just immediately was a galvanizing force for the Ducks offense. And so to see him get drafted where he did, that was pretty cool.
Well, Dane, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on here talking about all these guys, and pleasure to watch you work throughout the process. So go take some well-deserved time off, coach the heck out of those little league teams, and go win a championship over there. All right. Thanks, man.
Yeah, pleasure's been all mine. Take care, man.
All right. That is Dame Brugler of The Athletic, the best in the biz. And man, you heard from him a lot about the Seahawks draft. I meant to give Dane a bit of advice. I forgot to give him this, that in his next version of the beast, that as he's scouting guys for the Seahawks, he's got to check out the mustache game. Like, an absolute key component of being a Seahawk right now for this version of the Seahawks is what kind of stash you can rock, because Gray Zabel, Robbie Utes, those guys, they're bringing their A game. So that is going to become a prerequisite, I think, for future Seahawks draft evaluators. But good stuff as always from Dane. And you heard him talk about Torrey Horton being a guy that he had much higher, and he thinks you got a potential discount on. He had Riley Mills as a guy that was a top 100 before he got his injury. And so that's kind of the story of this draft for the Seahawks, is not only did you get some top shelf, high ceiling talent, but in a lot of cases, you got it lower than maybe the expected price to pay. Nicky Minwori was a first round pick by most accounts. And in fact, that kind of, like, I'm going to go back to this. I'll look at this in a second, but if you kind of go throughout, Elijah Arroyo for a lot of people was someone who could have been picked higher than he was. You talk about Jalen Milroe. A lot of people thought he might go as high as the first round. You could talk about Riley Mills. Torrey Horton is, I've heard from multiple people. I was talking to Matt Harmon from Reception Perception. That's one of his favorite day three picks overall for the NFL was Torrey Horton to the Seahawks. He can't believe that he fell to the fifth round. I'll try to see if I can get Matt on. We can talk a little bit more about Mr. Horton. You know, you kind of keep going through, and there was just a lot of people really think Damian Martinez in the seventh round was a crazy deal. Dane didn't have that same perception, and he ended up being closer to correct. But, you know, Nicky Minwori, I was looking at his predicted, like, where he was going to go. You know, he was projected to be a first round pick since basically the beginning of March, like late February. You know, the fact that you get him, he was as high as, you know, a consensus 23. He got to the 23rd ranked prospect from a consensus big board perspective at the beginning of April. And to get that guy as well as the consensus 18, so you got the consensus like 18 and 23 overall without having to go up to 23 to get him was pretty good. So I see our resident troll saying he's projected around 32. I'm looking at the mock draft database, and I'm looking at when he peaked and that he was a first round pick, even if it was 30, close to 30 by the time the draft came around, that's still a first round pick. So these were all, I think, good deals in general value for the Seahawks. And I think some really good upside as well. So that'll do it for today. Tomorrow, we're going to welcome in Ryan Fowler of the Draft Network. I want to go in a little deeper with Ryan on some of the undrafted free agents. He'll know those guys really well. So we'll go a little bit more in detail there. We'll get his opinion of this draft class. You know, as these are the two draft experts that I chose to spend the most time with over this period. And and wanted to make sure we closed the loop with them as we kind of transition from draft into rookie minicamp and OTAs and getting prepared for what will eventually be training camp, you know, just around the corner. All right, everybody, if you haven't given the show a like and click subscribe, please do. I greatly appreciate it. If you haven't gone to JK Boots recently, why are you not? Using code HawkBlogger, jkboots.com will get you $75 off. The best boots you're ever going to own. Spokane-based, family-owned company. These are all handmade. My JK Boots are amazing. They feel so comfortable. I wear orthotics, and I was told by the guys at JK Boots, you don't need to wear orthotics. They will form to your feet and give you the arch support. It's crazy. Like, I wear all sorts of different kinds of shoes. These are the only shoes where I don't have to wear orthotics because they are so supportive, so comfortable, and just so durable. They're like ass kickers. So I love these boots. They're worn by firefighters. They're worn by, you know, plumbers and construction workers and anyone who's on their feet all the time. And they're just worn for people that want to have boots that look good with your jeans or whatever else. So use code HawkBlogger, get $75 off. And for everyone that uses code HawkBlogger, they will give $15 to the Wildland Firefighters Foundation that benefits Northwest Forest firefighters. So it's a great deal for everybody. Head on over to JK Boots. You won't regret it. All right. Thank you, everybody. Make sure you give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Until tomorrow, I'm Brian Emhauser. This has been another episode of HawkBlogger Morning.